you want and what you think is desirable, so that one of the things is to redo our interpretation of what we want or expect. And I think you assume a kind of stable notion of what people are going to want.
Well, no, I assume that people's expectations increase, but I think it is disastrous to increase people's expectations faster than we can increase our ability socially to satisfy them.
The expectations and a radical reinterpretation of the expectations is what the problem is the locus of the problem. I mean, their expectations is the locus of the problem.
Okay, yeah.
Not the government.
Well, except that I would tie the government up with that. I mean, what created... The government has, in the case of every one of the problems that I just mentioned, poverty, cities, crime, welfare, drugs, fine-tuning, the government has clearly created extravagant expectations.
I don't know if you can say that. I think that saying that the government created it is part of the genie concept of government. Isn't it?
Well, I'd hate to be hoist with my own petard, but I can...
You're saying that government doesn't really have... the kind of power you're talking about, but
I think the government very definitely has the power to create extravagant expectations. And that this occurs through the democratic political process where each candidate out-promises the other. A beautiful case study is Nixon's record on crime. The promises he made. By golly, the trouble with one of the reasons we had to get the Democrats out of office and keep them out of office is they didn't do anything about crime. And all of these magnificent pronouncements about what he was going to do about crime led us to expect solutions that just are not going to be found given the nature of our social life.
Or given the interpretation of what is required to do something about crime.
Mm-hmm. Given the interpretation.
The interpretation leads to expectation. And if you thought you had to redo your whole society and its expectations in order to do something about crime, then you wouldn't really be expecting much very soon.
Well, I suspect that we're talking, you and I'm thinking you're talking a little bit past each other here on this.
Why don't you go on and get this thing laid out?
But I want to...
Tomorrow I'm going to give another lecture on freedom.
Okay. But... I would assert, I've been convinced of this very reluctantly. I came into economics as a liberal socialist, a kind of a Marxist, and I retreated from Marxism for a variety of reasons and was a left-wing socialist, and I kind of pulled back to a kind of a left-wing Democrat. And it's been a process of successive disillusionments for me as the causes which brought me into economics and ethics have proved to be vain causes. So I'm not gloating. I'm not saying, I told you so all along. I'm a little embarrassed to meet people that I was arguing with 10 years ago, 5 years ago. But I have been reluctantly convinced that the federal government has solved very few major social problems and has created a considerable number. And that we don't recognize this because we are so enamored of the genie conception of government. And I ran across... a little historical tale that I think beautifully illustrates a set of social consequences that are typical of almost all the situations I'm talking about. The Roman Republic was very good for a while at administering conquered territories. They actually did bring peace where there had previously been chaos and war. And they sent out governors who had high standards of justice and responsibility, who treated these people the way they would have treated citizens of Rome and of the Italian peninsula. But gradually, those positions came to be regarded as plums, those provincial governor jobs. And they were assigned, they were assigned to senators and knights, because they were the most noble, the most capable people, the clear aristocrats and patricians, who would go out and behave as patricians, as fathers. But gradually people began competing in Rome to rise up in the senatorial and knightly ranks, in order to get a governorship so that they could go out and milk the provinces. And maybe the system became increasingly corrupt. Now, here you have the people who are sent to create order, in fact, are creating disorder. Government is creating disorder in the form of extortion. But Rome recognized and set up what they called extortion courts, which would go in invest when charges were made in the province that the governor was enriching himself and his friends and his family through his administration of the laws. The extortion court would go in and investigate, and if it found the governor guilty, it could strip him of office and send him back to Rome. But eventually, I don't know how long it took, Cicero is complaining. In his attack on Verres, who was the governor of Sicily and was one of the very, very corrupt governors, Cicero says that the provinces are beginning to call for an abolition of the extortion courts. Because, Cicero says, the provinces say, we can afford, at great cost and a great burden, enough extortion to enrich the governor and his friends and his family. But we cannot afford the additional burden now of enriching also the members of the extortion court, their friends, and their families. What happened was that these governors, simply got more graft out of the system in order to pay the bribes that they had to pay in order to get verdicts of acquittal. Oh, that is a parable.
Yeah, apparently, a full employment law for a lawyer.
Yeah, right. And the poverty program has enriched social workers.
All my rich friends go to Europe on the poverty program.
Now, you know, where to begin? I told you I was going to tell you how we get out of this bind. I lied. It has to begin with understanding. I think we have to begin by understanding that the federal government, we have to look honestly at the record of the federal government. And it will help us if we realize that government is human beings, not a magical genie. And if we study the federal government, I think we will increasingly discover that almost inevitably, the federal government will not express the will of the people, not even the will of the majority. But the federal government expresses the will of successive small minorities. That's the way it works. Of successive small minorities. In other words, each minority has its turn. I'm not saying that the government is running in the interest of one minority, but the government acts in the interest of successive minorities, all kinds of minorities, special interests. And out of this does not emerge the public interest. Even in those cases where the statute itself may express the majority will or something we could call the public interest, implementation of the statute probably will not, given a little time to evolve. You could take the Interstate Commerce Act and show how this happened. You could show that I can demonstrate that the Interstate Commerce Act was not passed the way it was set up, and I would argue too, the way it was passed, not because the public wanted protection against extortionate railroads, but because railroads wanted protection against competition. And the way the Interstate Commerce Commission has behaved over the years, it does not provide us with an efficient public transportation system. The Interstate Commerce Commission for years existed in order to maintain, protect the interests of all of the shipping companies in the country, and still does. I can show you some, you know, we think it regulates the shippers. I'll show you truck line number 13 for 1974. This is the publication of the American Association of Truckers out of Washington, D.C., and they send literature out to their members. And they're warning them that the word is going around Washington, that their paper is going around Washington, urging that the Interstate Commerce Commission be abolished. And therefore, we truckers and the Interstate Commerce Commission, we have to get together and prepare memoranda to convince the public that this would be disastrous to everybody in the country. Isn't that interesting? That association against whose greed and avarice we are supposed to be protected is out there educating us to recognize that we need protection against their greed and avarice. You can multiply these examples all over the place. One of the things that critics of government commissions began arguing some years ago was that commissions do not protect the interests of the consumer, but the interests of the producer, that they are captured by the industries they're supposed to regulate. More recently, we have discovered that these government commissions operate primarily to protect the interests of the regulating commissions. that the Interstate Commerce Commission acts primarily to perpetuate the Interstate Commerce Commission. And because it is considered to be the expert in this area, it is terribly hard to dislodge. That was a digression. I said that the government, although it contained in all of that, I think you'll see some of the reasons why I would argue that the federal government is going to be controlled by successive minorities. Let me just give you one example, a better one maybe to illustrate this. We all use watches. Or almost all of us use watches. Now, we have an interest then, and I don't suppose anybody here works for a watch company, owns stock in a watch company. We all have an interest in having low cost, you know, cheap, inexpensive, and quality watches. Now, the Swiss makes some nice ones. But the government, the federal government, taxes them. Why does it tax them? It taxes them because the people in America who make watches don't want the competition. Well, they're a small minority. Why is it that they've gotten their way? And the answer is that they have enough of an interest in this particular issue to make it worth their while to get organized and to go down to Washington and put pressure on congressmen. So that there are congressmen whose re-election is determined to some significant degree by how they behave in response to this well-financed, highly active, and vocal special interest. The rest of us, we benefit just a little bit if they remove the tariffs from Swiss watches or don't put a new tariff on. But it isn't enough to persuade us to get active and to send representatives down there and put pressure on congressmen.
Incidentally, they often have no watch factories in their district.
But then they trade off.
Become spokesmen.
Yeah, they become spokesmen. They get contributions. They get I've never heard of any contributions being made to congressmen congressional campaigns by the Watch Users Association, but they are made by the Watchmakers Association. And this example can be multiplied many times throughout our society. Against this sort of thing, do we have any protection? People say, does any congressman ever consider the public interest? He does not, as I said, it argued at the beginning, does not consider the public interest if pursuit of the public interest is not in his private interest. I hope that's not cynical. I think it's just realistic. But now I would argue that that becomes less likely. The thing is that the politician's private interest is less likely to embrace the public interest as the size of the political community expands. I find, and I'm going to quote in just a couple minutes, so you think I haven't presented a solution, but maybe the solution will emerge as we talk. I find that over the years I have been advocating a set of political principles based on democracy as discussion, the importance of rational, moral, and political discourse. The possibility that the public interest can be found through rational discourse, and that's the meaning of a democratic society. Those are the principles that I've been advocating for many years. I've recently discovered that the principles I have been advocating are appropriate to the Greek city-state. And in fact, we live in the Roman Empire. In an empire, and I think it is useful to think of the United States now as an empire run by a bunch of imperialists. Not just because of what we do to other people in other countries, but because of what these people do to even to us. Gertrude was telling me about a case, I won't get into the details are not important, but the way taxing of some insurance income, and it's obviously unfair. And Gertrude could run around and talk to everybody in this village. She could probably talk to every citizen in the United States, and they would all agree it's grossly unfair. She could talk to the people in the Internal Revenue Service, and they would tell her it's unfair, and they would say, it's the law. She could talk to a congressman, and they say, the law has to be changed. It sure is unfair. No. But unless she's willing to go to all the trouble to get a special piece of legislation enacted, what every citizen thinks is unfair will nonetheless be done. Why? When you go to the Internal Revenue Service, then you discover imperialism in action. The guy at the Internal Revenue Service agrees that justice is on your side, but what must every imperialist do? Cover his behind. He's in a bureaucracy. He's not interested. He agrees your cause is right, but that's not his interest. His interest is protecting his job. He dare not make an exception. You cannot write on a form, you know, disposition of case, such and such, reason, elementary justice. You've got to say Rule 5DC, Section 6. The in an empire, the concept of the public interest is simply too broad and general to operate with any vivacity and concreteness. The polis, the word for the Greek city-state, the polis, from which our word political is derived, is small enough for the public interest to be a lively and informing concept. And it's small enough for the polis to train its citizens in the political virtues which are essential to a good political order. Do you know what I am saying, Kitty? Saying that we have to go back to the Greek city-state. I'm very serious about this. I'm sure there are problems that I haven't thought about, but I've been encouraged by the discovery that the problems I have thought about are remarkably soluble. I think we are going to have to find a way to create, to make the meaningful governmental units small. And within these polises, within these political communities, and I think I can use the word political, I will use the word political community, because if it's too large to be a political community, it is too large for my taste. I am not advocating states' rights. Much, much too big. I'm not advocating local government rights. Counties are much too big. I think we have to go back to, maybe it never existed. It did exist for a while in Greece, I'm sure. But we have to find a way to assign those powers of government which we deem still essential to government units that are associated with very small political communities. Now, there are two kinds of problems that people will immediately say, well, gee, won't that lead to chaos and anarchy? You have all these Greek city-states fighting with one another. That's one problem. And I think the answer is no, that won't happen. But that's a very complex question, and we'll get into that maybe. The other objection is going to come from people for whom that's too small a conception. From people who would not be content to create a good society that only contains 750 people. Because they think that their responsibilities go far beyond that. They would not be content to eliminate racism and sexism and all forms of exploitation and poverty and everything else within a small community, because they'd always be looking over there and seeing all of that injustice, real or imagined, in somebody else's community. I am coming to the conclusion, I have come to the conclusion, that the best is the faithful enemy of the good. That if we are determined to create justice everywhere, or actually if we are determined to create justice and to be responsible for the creation of justice over an area that is more than human-sized, we will fail. And we will fail to create justice anywhere. But if we are willing to limit our horizons, we will have the possibility of creating islands of justice, little good societies here and there. And many little good societies do add up to one big chunk of goodness.
I don't know if this is a good example. It's bringing down on a very little basis. We have a lot of migrant Mexicans in that area for growing season.
Rock Island, Illinois?
Right. And Mike Hines, tomato people are all in our area, the onion pickers are all in our area, and everything. And our college was working with combined churches of the area in what we thought was ghetto area, where these people were told they had to live. We assumed that there were great problems there. It's all sort of borders on the downtown along the Mississippi. And these college kids were assigned to go in there incognito, not reveal who they were, but go as a worker, sit with them in the restaurants, and get a feel of what these people felt about how they had to live, and whether they were unhappy, whether they were unhappy with the employment. And to their surprise, they came out with, there was very little crime in this area. All the crime was done from the Snob Hill crowd up in the really good areas of the city, supposedly. But that's where the missingness was most of the dope was. These little collective communities of famine took care of their own needs so beautiful that we found the crime didn't exist down there, what we assumed was the ghetto part of our area. And that's bringing down to the family unit, as might be an example, that they took care of right there, we and the family took care of the kids. And they were not unhappy with the situation because they had this family unity. Although they agree that there are different levels of Mexicans within the group that don't understand, you know, the way might have been the upper. So I don't know how much they were willing to help the other, except that I was on a council with them where they would be doing tutoring and so forth to help these people out of that kind of enslavement. But we thought it was very revealing that where our problem was not what we thought it was.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, Gordon, because, you know, these problems that I ticked off, with the exception of the fine-tuning one, I think are all problems created by the absence of community in the United States. Poverty, you may disagree, but I'd have to argue that. But I think poverty is fundamentally a problem of community. Well, you know, a person isn't poor simply because he doesn't have a lot of monetary income. There are people with very little monetary income who are not poor. The people with quite a bit monetary income who are poor, they don't know how to spend it. They fritter it away and get themselves deeply in debt, and what they're doing is they're trying to get satisfaction out of life. Their whole life is bound up in getting satisfaction out of spending money, and they just can't get enough money to get that kind of satisfaction. And I think when you get down to it, there's no simpler, more comprehensive answer to the question of what's wrong there than that they don't live in communities. Our cities, that's the problem. See, why is it that the crime rate is low in the small towns? Because small towns are communities. Small town, somebody commits a crime. If somebody in the town holds up the drugstore, the whole town sympathizes with him. They can't believe it. They gossip about it, of course, but that's a sign it's a community. But they care for him. They care for the criminal. Welfare. The problem with our welfare program is that we are trying to get the advantages of a personal welfare system out of an empire. We can't get it. And the demand for welfare expands far beyond the capacity of the system to provide it. Because we have no communities. Drugs. I think it is the alienation from community that is leading more people to seek for satisfaction and meaning in drugs. I haven't said anything about racism, but racism is obviously a problem, a lack of community. Now, there's a tricky one there.
Yes.
Because Julie was pointing out to me last night that I always rehearsed my arguments with my wife. Who's really, I'm not saying this just to be polite, an awfully patient and valuable critic and colleague over the years. She just doesn't write the things I say, but she tests them all. I might tell you, she has not yet approved these lectures. She finds them interesting. But one of the objections that she raised last night was, how can you say that the federal government has not solved any major social problems in view of all that the federal government has done to overcome racism in the last 20 years?
No.
And I think the federal government has done a lot to overcome racism. I think that the Supreme Court decision, an autocratic Yeah, autocratic decision. There were 9 men in black robes who told us, contrary to the will of the people and contrary to the will of Congress, that we couldn't behave this way. And we said, you can't legislate morality. Well, the Supreme Court proved, though, that you could slowly legislate behavior. And then when you change behavior, morality gradually changed too. And that's gain. That's real gain. And I, you know, searching for ways to, I was asking, why did the federal government succeed here? And I'm not altogether sure. But then I remembered Adolf Hitler. And I remembered what it is, and I remembered the American Indian. And I came back and I said, oh, hold it here. I've fallen victim to the genie conception of government again. I've assumed that because the federal government in the United States has, in a particular dramatic and significant instance, successfully reduced racism, therefore the federal government can reduce racism and will reduce racism. And if you've got a problem of prejudice and discrimination, turn it over to the federal government. But what keeps the government from handling it the way it handled the Indian? Or what keeps the federal government from handling the race problem the way Hitler handled the race problem? There is no virtue in government that automatically guarantees that when it acts, it will act on behalf of justice and brotherhood.
Incidentally, Hitler in his table talk and with Rauschenig, the first authentic talk from Hitler, the leader of Danzig, said, people don't want reason, they want primitive magic. Variation of your genie view. But the one reason that I was for federal legislation on race was using the analogy of Nazi Germany. When the Nazis said, fire your Jewish workers and quit association with your Jewish friends, very little happened. Germans had enough sense of plain decency to continue being friendly with their Jews and Lutheran and Catholic factory owners continued with Jewish workers. When the Nazis made it a law, they quit associating as friends, and they fired the Jewish workers from the factories. But the great proclamations, even after the Night of Crystal, association with Jews and Germans continued, but it became a law right after that. Then it stopped it altogether. Well, I that affected me profoundly in supporting the federal legislation for the fair employment.
Yeah, well, I supported it too, and I supported the 54 decision, and I look back and I am grateful for it. But I'm looking back this morning and also thinking how lucky we were, because I don't see it inevitable that the court would go that way or the federal government would go that way. There are all sorts of other ways for it that it could possibly go. And I think right now, on the whole airship, I think the government is now demonstrating its capacity to practice coercion in the name fraternism, male term too. But some of the rules that the federal government is now, some of the regulations the federal government is now passing in order to prevent discrimination on the basis of race and sex are tyrannical and unjust by any measure that I can think of. It's a gross perversion of justice. It is a demonstration of our incapacity to think politically when we argue that by requiring employers to give preference to a woman over a man, we are atoning for past injustices. Mm-hmm. What we are doing is discriminating against a particular man. And to say, well, that's okay, because you men discriminated against us women for decades, is quite beside the point. That guy didn't do the discriminating, did he? And I am increasingly disturbed by the way in which the people who are enforcing these regulations are the ones who are not bearing the cost of them. Down at the universities, it's the people way up the top whose positions are secure who are discriminating way down at the bottom. It's the corporation executive who says, I'm going to be a great promoter of social justice. I'm going to hire blacks in preference to whites. And so he dumps poor white blue-collar workers out on the labor market, even though their qualifications were better than those of the blacks. This is a very, very difficult problem, but to suppose that the federal government is now, with its affirmative action programs, showing us the pathway to justice, I think is an absurdity.
But you're arguing content. I want to go to the principle.
Okay.
I really want to raise a question about whether you really mean to go to the Greek conception of the polis.
Mm-hmm.
The Greeks, both Plato and Aristotle, begin with the assumption that there is a good, that the good can be known, and that people can learn and discover what the good is.
Right, and I accept that.
Okay. Now, what you argue against in the big government is the principle of coercion. And you are arguing for your small government on the basis of the principle of wisdom. Now, you never argue in dealing with the big size that it's impossible for the big state to know the good. There you argue on the basis of coercion, and you don't argue on the basis of the small state from the point of view that coercion will be less necessary.
Okay, yeah, that's okay. Critical point, and I jumped over that too quickly, but I did mean to assert that in the big state, what I call now the empire, it is impossible to attain wisdom. You do not have that kind of political discourse. It is impossible for citizens to train one another in the political virtues which will enable them to be wise and to promote the good and to recognize the good. All that's possible in the empire is arbitrary definitions of partial goods imposed upon people. The reason, I would argue, that in a small community, in the polis, the necessity for coercion diminishes is precisely because political education is possible in the polis, and it is not possible in the empire.
Yeah. But you still have a problem. I haven't got quite clear what the principle is yet. That is, in Mao's state, in 42, everybody was required to spend 2 hours a day studying 21 documents and to take examinations on them and participate in discussion. There was education and what was considered to be wisdom. And that went throughout the whole of China. Now, you might say that that process was going on. It did involve somebody's conception of what the wisdom was, which was informing the process. Now, if you think there is no wisdom like that that informs the process, you may want to say that you've got to get the kind of a process going which isn't informed by anything, but which can go on long enough and intimately enough so something can emerge because of the process. A different conception of wisdom, you see.
Okay. Is everybody following this? Or I was his student. let me try to find this. Begin with Mao.
I'm still hearing absolutes, you know, like you're searching after wisdom or something. And we don't live in that kind of a world anymore.
Yeah, that's some kind of input, though.
We're just looking at their principle to make a decision about anything.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay. Let's start dealing with this. So we don't live in a world of that. The word wisdom, the good, these terms offend the modern ear. The first question we ask is, who's going to define it? That's why we're suspicious of these words that seem to come with capital letters prefixed. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we may be suspicious of them, but in fact we operate with them. You know, everybody does. You may say, well, this often happens in classes. We'll get into a discussion of, I teach a course called The Nature of Man, which has been shifted now to On Becoming Human, where we get into sexism. That's been the hot topic. A few years ago it was racism. Now it's sexism is the hot topic. And people start to argue with one another. And at some point, the argument tends to break down into name-calling or sulking and being sullen. Now, if you push these people, what everybody says, or what people tend to say in order to preserve their dignity, is that, well, you know, who can say? Who can say? You know, it's all relative. There's no justice with a capital J governing male-female relationships. But in fact, what they're saying is, I've got a set of principles here that I hold on to, and I don't know how to defend them against your arguments, and so I'm going to say it's all relative. Now, if we are going to live in a political community, we have to bring those principles with which we are operating into conflict. We have to engage one another. We can't live in the same community when your conception of justice with a capital J, and you have one, and mine don't coincide. Now, the first process then that Al is talking about is the first principle, I think, has to be the principle of commitment to that process of dialogue. And here I think Mao is a genius. I think Mao is a philosopher king. That doesn't mean I endorse everything he's done. I think he has some blind spots. Modern social economic problems.
Spots.
Yeah, and some bloody spots too.
Yeah, we got 50.
All right, but you know, but darn it, I know of no one in the 20th century who has more beautifully expressed in a variety of works what I would call the liberal democratic political philosophy. That is the philosophy of commitment to dialogue, to rational persuasion, to the process of the republic, of the Platonic dialogue, than Chairman Mao. The only candidate that I would set against him is Martin Luther King, whose letter from Birmingham jail is a brilliant statement of that philosophy.
Of course, King never operated on it. That's right. He operated as a charismatic leader, making the decisions himself without much discussion.
Well, that may be. I'm talking about the expression of his philosophy. But he also, Al, darn it, he would go in there. I mean, his tactics were to go in and confront until... you're talking about his dealing with people inside the movement. I'm talking about his dealing with people outside the movement, to people whom he's trying to move. His tactic was to confront them, coerce them, only until he brought them into dialogue. And he would stop. And they would talk. If they stopped talking, King would use coercion. And now Mao, the trouble is I do not generalize from Mao to our society, as many of my Marxist friends do. They've seen Mao as the savior of the world. There are far, far too many differences between American and Chinese societies, including differences in extent of evolution, including the fact that the Chinese still remember how it was under the Generalissimo, and they don't want to go back there. But a generation is coming along that will not remember how it was under the Generalissimo. And what is going to happen to this national unity, which Mao has been able to use effectively to keep the country reasonably together? I wonder what's going to happen to the dialogue. I wonder how willingly people will go to these dialogue sessions and talk about the good of the commune when they've forgotten how awful the past was. The frequency of the reminders, in Chinese society, the frequency of the reminders of how it used to be and do you want to go back there is still a powerful force.
What I was asking, though, was whether you agree with the principle of the public philosophy.
Yes.
Because he embodies the principle of the public philosophy, and in America we are against the principle of the public philosophy.
I am in favor of the principle of the public philosophy, very strongly, yes.
But the principle of the public philosophy has to be set over against the principle of self-initiation, which I see, and voluntarism, which I see so strong in your analysis negatively.
Yeah, but it's not as strong as you think it is, because... See, I'm a kind of an individualist. My analysis of the state and of the economy presumes individuals acting in their own interests. And what Al notices is that I'm seeing that when those individuals act in their own interests in the federal government, we get a mess. And he wants to know, how come when those individuals act in their own interest in my little polis, we aren't going to get a mess? And it's because when those individuals are acting in their own interest in the federal government, their private interests aren't growing, they aren't expanding. When they're acting in their own interest in the polis, their conceptions of their private interest are being enriched by their perceptions of the private interests of others, and out of this is emerging the public interest. It is the fact that they can be and are forced to be in dialogue with one another in the polis, meeting one another as human beings, and that's really the only kind of dialogue that works, that causes them to be self-initiators, it's true, but not individualists.
Paul, I'd like to use it, say an example that may illuminate that, because I keep thinking about this community. You know, when you say community, I think Holland Village, because Holland Village is a place that's helped me to think about what community is. I've lived here over a long period of time. I've lived here. Call this my home. And one thing that I think would be happening in your polis, it's not happening here, is that we depend on the goodwill of, you know, of the people around us to come in here and to hold us up. When we don't grow our food, we don't produce, you know, our trucks and stuff, neither would your polis. But it would trade. It would have. Now we're participating in a kind of a trade too here at the village, you know. But I think that maybe we don't recognize that, and it's very autocratic. I have very little power. You know, something may be irking me tremendously about, you know, the way the food is cooked or about some policy over here somewhere. But I don't have much power to do anything about it. I don't have anything to trade with. Huh? If I don't like it, I can go. Yeah. You know, and the thing is that, and this is, you know, something I live with all the time now. But I can see that kind of a community operating together would give the people living in it the power to, you know, to talk to their friends and neighbors, because they themselves are an integral part of this community that's happening. And it's not, you know, people hopefully wouldn't be saying, if you don't like it, go elsewhere. They would have that freedom, I would hope, but they would have also the freedom to stay. But I also see that as a problem. You know, how is that going to happen? The people actually do have the power so that they can say to somebody over here, hey, and this guy doesn't say to them, well, if you don't like it, you know.
Well, you pointed to what I've recognized as one of the real serious problems with what I'm proposing. And that is that as long as there exist many, many communities, people will have many, many choices. And very often the grass will be greener on the other side of the fence until you get there. People may become too mobile between communities. You know, here's a guy who can't stand this welfare system, so he goes off to a community that proclaims, if any would not work, neither shall he eat. And then he finds out, oh, but I didn't think it meant this. And moreover, the danger is the most mobile people are the most imaginative people. You know, they can weigh what's going on, assess possibilities. The best people may be floating around among communities so often as to deprive each community of some of the most important resources for the development, for its own inner development. That, I think it's a very serious danger. By the way, let me just say this quickly. The place to begin, and what I'm doing, beginning to do, I am working intensely on the creation of communities. I don't want to abolish the federal government first and then see if we can't create communities that can handle most governmental functions. I want to create communities that are handling so many functions that they no longer have to appeal to government. And meanwhile, I am resisting any extension of the federal government with might and main. I vote no on everything. And I'm playing like a demagogue on all dissatisfactions with the federal government. I've become an anarchist with respect to the federal government. But I do think that we have to move on both fronts simultaneously. Ms. Dirks?
Isn't our
Okay, Ms. Dirks, then, Chief.
I was just wondering if you were considering the unions, the powerful unions in our government.
The unions,
part that they play.
Unions have been made powerful by the federal government.
But the parts they play in the whole picture.
Well, I mean, what?
You haven't mentioned them at all, yet the head of the union goes to the government and dictates what he thinks should be done.
Well, this is just another one of those successive minorities that's getting its way, I think.
Well, they're not in the minority.
Well, they are. They surely
have more money than the government.
They're still a minority, aren't they, Mr. Dirks? They're a minority. They're surely not. They're not. Union members and their families certainly don't make up 100 million people in the United States. They make up about 40 million. So that's a minority, but of course the interests, the so-called the interests of unions, that's not one either. What happens is that particular interests get, in fact, and the interests that get most, the union interests that get most effectively represented are the interests of those unions that already represent the most, the wealthy and powerful and privileged members of society. The farm workers union doesn't have a whole lot of influence in where it counts. What has influence is the building trades.
That's their hole in there now,
yeah.
The farming. That's why your people are more satisfied.
Well, I haven't answered your question, but there are lots of other questions I haven't answered. Chief?
Well, I was wondering, isn't it a little difficult to set up these communities with our tax structure the way it is, because it's so hard for small government units to do anything because they don't have the means to tax, or I mean the larger government units are taxed.
Right, the federal government appropriates the most of the sources of tax revenue, and what it doesn't appropriate, the state appropriates, and then the county comes in and grabs the rest. And yes, that's true, but I think that while that creates a problem, it creates a serious problem, I think we would be surprised to discover how many resources we have available in the community if we set our tasks to it and set our minds to it. For example, schools. Schools are a good example of where the government has preempted the field. The government has created a monopoly. The government has argued from a very clear externality free rider argument, which says that if every citizen chooses for his children the quantity of education that is in his and his children's best interest, he will choose too little. Because by getting educated, you confer benefit on yourself and also upon other people. And we stop when we bring the benefits to ourselves into line with the cost to ourselves. So in order to encourage people to take the socially proper amount, the government will subsidize education. Now, that makes sense. That's a perfectly logical argument. But that doesn't require that the government have a monopoly in the control of the school. All that the government would have to do is subsidize education, or subsidize students. But instead, what the government has done is created schools, said you must go to school, and we will preempt the taxation to make sure that most people have to go to the schools the government creates. Parochial schools, are terrible times, and the only people who can afford to go to private schools are wealthy people. And if you check into the history of all of this legislation, guess who's responsible for it all? It's been the public school teachers. You can go back in the 19th century, a guy named West, E.G. West, done some very interesting studies on the history of compulsory education in the United States. It was the teachers' lobbies that were getting compulsory education laws passed in state after state because they were noticing the kids weren't coming and their jobs were being threatened. And of course, they're the ones who oppose, who drag out the church-state separation. Now, that's a serious problem, but you know what? Suppose that we just forgot the whole thing. Suppose that we just decided to educate our kids ourselves.
You like the voucher system?
Yeah, I like the voucher system. But I like something else, too. I like the idea of parents getting together and educating their own children.
If the state will let them, huh?
Yes, if the state will let them. It's
like
amazing.
I just read an editorial by, of all people, James J. Kilpatrick the other day, who I have a hard time agreeing with most of the time when I read him, but he read of a situation in Ohio where there's a church group now that they are educating their kids, and the state agrees that they are being taught reading, writing, arithmetic, and blah, 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 and all that. But they don't have enough water fountains in the hall that meet the state requirements, huh? A couple of things like that. Therefore, the state is saying to them, your schools are inadequate. You have to, comply or else go to the state schools. Well, they can't afford to maybe build a big new building, with plenty of water fountains and so forth. So they're in a bind, and they're appealing it, but who knows?
But the only way they're going to win this is when the public becomes so disgusted with the state monopoly of education that we rise in revolt. And so this is another little thing I'm doing. I'm encouraging all discontent with state education. it is interesting in the field of education. You've heard of input-output analysis, even if you don't know what it means. In education, we use input-input analysis. Do you know how we measure the quality of education? By the amount of money we spend on it.
Huh.
That is the only, that if you look in the statistical, that's the only measure we have. How good is our educational system? We look how much money we spend. That means that the more inefficient we become, the better educated we become. And who, you know, it's obvious who supports a system like that. The school gets better every time it adds another assistant principal because it's spending more money. And, you know, one of the things, Al keeps, Al and I've been talking for a long time, which is why I'm not always, but, you know, Al, one of the things that really bothers me, I mentioned this when I gave those five reasons back at the beginning, five terrible things that were happening. One of the things that all of this reliance on the empire is doing, the genie conception of government is doing, is sapping our ability, willingness to initiate action in communities, to work together. We just assume, if we've got a social problem, example, my neighbor, slightly downhill, right next to me, just down there, has a strange habit. He takes good care of his lawn, beautiful, beautiful lawn, but he rakes all of his grass and leaves into the street, just over the curb, and there it sits. It's a mess. Read in the newspaper that the city of Dallas had passed an ordinance that this was illegal.
Yeah.
And you would be warned once and then fined $50 and fined $100 for a second offense. Well, I just sort of watched. Nothing happened. He continues it. I asked him once, I said, Jim, you know, you can get fined for that. He says, oh, I know. They've warned me already four times. And he said, but what are you going to do? He said, I got so much stuff in the leaves and the grass and everything. Well, I cost a fortune in bags to carry it all out to the, put in bags to carry it out to the alley. He says, so if they don't like it out there, they can sweep it up. And I found myself then rooting for the state in the city to come in and fine him. You know, and you know what happened? Then I realized what had happened, that the existence of the state had sapped my energy, my willingness and ability to deal with a community problem. And I have not dealt with that problem. I've got an erosion problem in my backyard, and I pick up, he puts in now nice neat piles right next to my property line, his grass and his leaves. I pick them up, carry them in my backyard and dump them. Problem solved. People in the neighborhood have been talking about, hey, do you notice Jim started cleaning up the street? But, you know, that's one answer, but I just think there are dozens of instances of that sort of thing.
Paul, once upon a time I was a primitive Southerner. Safeway store worked me in high school for 25 cents an hour, and then they wouldn't pay me for overtime at all. And so I had no concept of how to get justice, so I decided to rob the store. And so it was a very complicated story where I, with great cleverness, duplicated the key. And I put the key in one morning when I was helping my brother with the morning paper out to get justice. And the key turned, and I was just as if I had a hold of an electric wire. Then I thought of the horrible thing that would happen to my family if my name got in the paper, and I pulled the key out and never robbed the store. Because there was no idea of anybody bringing justice to me except myself.
No, your family and your community. What would you thought of? What would happen to your family if the word got out in the community?
Bringing bad names to my family was so horrible that I'd rather endure the injustice of them exploiting me as a sweeper and sacker.
Right. There were two just causes conflicting within you, but the community had a big role to play. Polis played a big role in your decision. And it doesn't who'd worry about that in Detroit? Al, you.
Yeah, well, I still think you have got more principles going than you enunciate whenever you take an example like education. The principle you appeal to in education is self-initiation, the voucher system. But last, when you gave your best phrase, you talked about the body of Christ. Now, in one, the presupposition is a bunch of individuals making up their own minds what to do. The other is a community responsible to each other, not making decisions individually, but in some sense expecting a brother to help them determine, and together the community deciding what to do. Now, it seems to me that two different principles are implied, and I haven't yet seen how you integrate that.
Well, Al, I'm supporting the voucher system as an interim measure, as a way of reducing the power of the state monopoly.
Self-initiation is the fundamental principle.
It's
your
not.
Thinking, and it isn't.
No, it's the fundamental logical, the analytical principle. In other words, I start with the assumption that each individual has free will and chooses with complete
chooses among the options available to him on the basis of his private interests. But that's an analytical step. But that is not what ought to be. It's an unrealistic abstraction.
But you see, that's the way in which you can identify yourself with a libertarian. But your view of man is quite different from the libertarian.
Yes, it is.
Of man. And it doesn't come, I don't think it comes across. And that's what I think bothers me. And I think you are advocating a radically new approach to American social philosophy. And it appears that you're advocating a return to libertarianism. But I think you're advocating the Greek notion is a notion which combines freedom as self-initiation with freedom as self-perfection, with a conception of what perfection is, what the good is. And so you really are appealing to two principles, and that is very different from American history. You really want to turn the tables on America and move in a different direction. Really, and you can't identify with a libertarian then, because they don't want to.
No, I really don't identify with the libertarians. I've never joined them. But I also don't think, I mean, you're quite right in your description of where I am, what I'm thinking, the principles working here. But I don't think that I'm completely reversing American history. I find in the Declaration of Independence, and in much of the work of Thomas Jefferson, which Bill Layman is going to be talking about the rest of this week, the principles, many of the principles that I'm interested in.
Also the
New England Town Meeting
idea. I think the
Puritan.
The Puritans are much closer. The meaning of under God and of communal responsibility. But the under God really means a substantive principle.
All right. Let me just run through the opening words of the Declaration of Independence and point out some of the principles that I accept. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve a people, you've got people, to dissolve the political bonds which connect them with another, and to assume among the peoples of the earth a separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. It's not simply a power play. A decent respect for the opinions of mankind, there's a bigger community to which you must answer, requires that they declare the causes which impel them to the separation. You have to justify what you're doing. Now, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Lay down the eternal principle. That's clearly not, that, you know, the Declaration of Independence is not consistent with the modern American political philosophy. But I want to go back to the Declaration of Independence. And I find that the Declaration of Independence, I can stand on that. I can confess that. I can also confess the Constitution, which I find a really remarkable document, which created structures that would be consistent with that philosophy. And the tragedy is that it hasn't been the Supreme Court, it's been the people. We wanted it. The Constitution has been jettisoned.
Incidentally, Lenin did not do that in Russia, and I'm skeptical that Mao has done the rough equivalent in China. After he dies, I don't know what will happen, whether they'll have a Stalin or not. But our Constitutional Fathers did a good job there.
Yeah. And the problem for Paul is to get into the community, which he specifies in terms of size and process, nature and nature's God. How does the small community that has dialogue involve itself in that dialogue, in the substance of nature and nature's God? That's what
And I think the answer to that is, in the political community, God speaks through the demand of every member of the community. I mean, I can't pull the Bible in unless everyone is committed to the Bible. In the political community, where I assume there are religious differences, because you can solve that problem by making basing your communities on religious agreement. But assuming that we don't have religious agreement, I cannot invoke some authority, Thomas Aquinas or the Old Testament. And yet, nature and nature and nature's God come in, but he speaks through the demand of every other person in the community. If there's no person in the community who is complaining about what we're doing, then as far as we're concerned at this moment in time, we are operating in accord with the laws of God.
That's a